Welcome to the Black History Podcast. I want to start this episode slightly different than I do most, and slightly different than I hope I'll ever have to do anymore after this, but that's by providing a bit of a commentary and narrative that will really kind of shape today's episode. And the predominant reason why is because while this episode was started months ago, what I want to say now actually hasn't changed much between when the episode was being planned and its time of recording. You know, truthfully, I just never really had the time to finalize the research and sit down to finally record. But, you know, it's especially prevalent because, as many of you know, I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and this community right now is actually awaiting the verdict from another situation where a police officer shot and killed an African-American man in his car, and the officer is actually charged with murder. So I would suggest that it's the first step to get the charge, the nexus to get the conviction, especially as this situation was videotaped. Now, today's episode was actually started around the same time as Philando Castile, the young man who was murdered in Minneapolis, Minnesota, right around the same time that that officer's verdict came out. And in light of the recent events and subsequent miscarriages of justice that we've come prepared to expect, you know, we decided to cover the Hunters Point Rebellion of 1966. And really, this diatribe is what I'll call it, is expressing continued disappointment in the judicial process in states across this country. You know, it's hurtful for me to say this, especially because I've devoted my professional life to an attempt at upholding the legal system and assisting people in achieving justice and righting wrongs. But predominantly, I've practiced business litigation and employment discrimination, and I don't practice criminal law. And I would only hope that that would present me with the latitude to give an indictment of the social climate in which we live and the sickening repetitive pattern of injustice that seemingly only impales one segment of the U.S. society. Now, again, you know, this episode was began right around the time that the verdict from Philando Castile came out. And it's such a shame that he was brutally murdered by a police officer in front of his daughter and his fiance while she live streamed the video to Facebook. But the outcome of that case is the same as so many others that we've seen, where all accounts point to blatant murder, but jury verdicts or prosecutors or anonymous grand juries fail to see what whole communities and social demographics are paying to watch. And I think we can all agree that it's well past time for true change to occur. And, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting different results. But that's exactly what we're doing. We've been down this path before where we see an egregious situation where eyewitness testimony, or in most recent years, videotaped evidence, supports the prevailing popular belief that someone should be properly held accountable, and yet each time the perpetrator walks away a free man or free woman, as long as the victim comes from a particularly identifiable racial demographic group, and we know the victims in general share the same immutable characteristic. Now, as an attorney, one thing I've continually been disappointed in is the substandard representation that our community has in jury pools. But it's deeper than just the 12 that make it to the deliberations. It's actually the efforts that are made by individuals to actively avoid serving on a jury. Now, I remember the first federal criminal case I was ever involved with. I was a clerk still in law school, actually, in Arkansas for a full service firm. And I had the opportunity to build a pretty good rapport and relationship with the partner that was actually handling this particular case. And he asked me to assist him in his trial preparation. And once we made it to trial, during the beginning of the voir dire, which is the time when the jury is selected, the general pool had maybe 50 to 60 jurors, potential jurors, and of that, maybe 4 to 5 African Americans. Now, our client was being charged with a violation of federal drug trafficking laws and was actually facing up to 40 years in prison for allegedly operating a marijuana grow operation in the foothills of the Ozark Mountains. And I will never forget, because it's emblazoned on my mind, that one of the potential jurors, African-American middle-aged woman, raised her hand without being summoned, without being asked, without being questioned, and stands up to announce before the defendant, the attorneys, the federal prosecutor, and the judge included, that she can't serve on a jury because she regularly smoked marijuana and couldn't be unbiased. Now, needless to say, she was excused from the jury, and I'm surely not suggesting that it's a good thing to have a biased jury, but that sample just goes to show the extra effort to not serve on a jury. I'm sure we all know people, and I hope it's none of you all, who absolutely refuse to serve on a jury. You know, the summons comes in the mail, people have an audible groan and express some anger, and the next thing, you make a phone call to the circuit court clerk with an excuse. But unless we take the opportunity, and I mean every opportunity to serve on jury duty and participate in shaping the outcomes of cases in our communities, then I think we'll continue to see the same results in an effort to continue perpetuating this same insanity. But you know, to be honest with you, it's deeper than just jury duty. And what I don't think that most realize is that jury duty, especially in criminal cases, is what shapes the prosecutor's office, both in approach and demographic makeup, but also in less overt ways, like in decisions as to deciding who gets charged and what they get charged with. Now, and I'm sorry for digressing, but you know, around the same time as Philando Castile's murder and the verdict that came out, I watched D.L. Hughley break down in tears as he openly discussed the verdict and its impact with a Caucasian host on national TV, and continually throughout the interview, as DL is in tears of pain, the host clearly didn't understand or have the requisite ability to properly and genuinely sympathize and understand the impact of the words that DL Hughley was saying. But this passion that DL expressed has multiple forms. Now, I would say that DL exhibited the physical manifestation of the pain and the solitary form through self-reflection, evidenced by his tears. Other people choose to exhibit a quiet, active expression on the nights following the verdict by peacefully protesting through the streets of Minnesota. But the third and final form is what sparked today's episode. So if you sit right there, I'll hit the music, as we normally do, and we'll start the show. But before I do, let me let the listeners know that, as I'm sure you might expect, the content we're going to talk about might be a bit graphic and will contain a bit of explicit language. So if you have younger listeners, as I actually hope that you do, you may want to pre-screen this episode and determine its appropriateness beforehand. With that said, let's start the show. Welcome to the Black History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. Almost 51 years ago, on September 27, 1966, a riot broke out in San Francisco's Hunter Point, a black neighborhood, when a white police officer shot and killed a 17-year-old African-American teen, Matthew Johnson Jr. There are two prevailing accounts of the incident in Hunter's Point. I'm sure you can guess, one would be the police account, while the other is provided by a man named Arthur Hippler and is set forth in a book he published in 1974 called Hunter's Point, A Black Ghetto. Hippler spends a vast portion of the book attempting to debunk the police account and lay forth the truth. Now, Hippler's book will actually play a large part in this episode, but there are other perspectives as well that will shape our telling today. So let's start with the setting for today's episode. To understand why the incident in question exploded the way it did, it's necessary predominantly to understand its history. So Bayview Hunters Point, or the Bayview as it is known, is a neighborhood in the southeast corner of San Francisco, California. The area has basically always been a shipyard, but not the fancy kind that you'd hope for if you live nearby. In the late 1800s, the area was known mainly for its slaughterhouses and animal butcher shops in the city. Between 1868 and 1878, more than 18 slaughterhouses were operated in the area, with their associated facilities for tanning, fertilizer, wool, and tallow development. The area took a hard decline just after the 1906 San Francisco earthquake until about the early 1970s when the final slaughterhouses closed down. Now, because of the location of the shipyard, the area was well known and heavily populated with blue-collar workers, most of which were African Americans taking part in the Great Migration. After World War II, when many African Americans were evicted from housing in other parts of the city due to racial segregation, between 1940 and 1950, the population of Bayview increased to 51,000 residents. Now, the Navy acquired an existing shipyard and launched an aggressive recruiting drive for workers nationwide. Tens of thousands of African Americans jumped on the opportunity to obtain good-paying jobs and also to escape the Jim Crow South. Thousands moved into hastily built dormitories in Hunters Point. Thousands more were crowded into the Western Addition, often into homes vacated by Japanese Americans who had been forced into internment camps. This influx of black workers radically altered San Francisco's racial makeup. Now, before the war, San Francisco's population of 600,000 was approximately 94.5% white. Of the 14,000 people who lived in Hunters Point and the adjoining larger Bayview neighborhood, just 7 were black at the time. By the end of the war, though, San Francisco's African-American population had risen more than sixfold to around 32,000. But after the war, the jobs began to dry up, and white residents left Hunters Point for other neighborhoods or the suburbs, an option that was not available to their black counterparts, who faced racial covenants and de facto discrimination. The housing stock, most of it intended to be temporary, deteriorated, and the already isolated neighborhood was marooned when the Bay Shore Freeway was built in 1958. Essentially, a generation of young men grew up in poverty, often in squalid public housing projects and in broken families. Drugs and violence spread rapidly. In just 15 years, Hunters Point went from a vibrant, multiracial neighborhood to what amounts to a ghetto. There was a former Hunters Point resident, James Lockett, who said, quote, "I turned to robbing to feed my family and the community. We couldn't get jobs. If you went downtown to look for work, they wanted skills, but there was no training. My mom was a single woman with 4 children. As we got older and hungrier, we decided we were going to eat like everyone else. We stole a quarter cow from James Allen's slaughterhouse and dragged it to the car. We fed about 30 families. We did what wasn't really a crime as crime today. It was survival." Now, by the 1960s, the Bayview Hunter Point neighborhoods were populated predominantly with African Americans and other racial and ethnic minority groups, essentially being isolated from the more desirable San Francisco area. As I'm sure you can imagine, the area was predominated with pollution, substandard housing, dilapidated infrastructure, limited employment, and most pressingly, racial discrimination. The issue is so stark that the great James Baldwin said this in 1963. "This is the San Francisco America pretends does not exist." It's a very telling statement by Baldwin that would come just 3 short years before the true topic of today's episode. In 1964 and 1965, black neighborhoods in Philadelphia, Harlem, Watts, and Cleveland erupted in violence. A new, militant generation of blacks was turning away from nonviolent civil rights organizations and embracing the fiery new ideology of black power. So what sparked the episode today? The story goes something like this. At 2:30 p.m. on a super hot September 27th, 1966 night, 3 African-American teenagers were joyriding through Bayview Hunters Point in a stolen 1958 Buick. Allegedly, the car stalled on Griffith Street near Oakdale Avenue, just as a police cruiser was pulling alongside. At the same time, three teenagers bolted from the car. Clifton Bacon, who was 15, and Matthew Johnson, who was 16, took off on foot, and Daryl Mobley, who was 14, took cover behind a nearby parked car. A white patrol officer with 23 years on the job, Alvin Johnson, chased Clifton Bacon and Matthew Johnson in his patrol car, attempting to cut them off at Navy Road. According to the official city report of the incident, the officer screamed out to Matthew Johnson, "Stop, hold it, or I'm going to shoot." Eerily similar to many of the instances gracing our headlines, Matthew Johnson was unarmed. As he ran away down a hill in a nearby housing project, the officer fired four shots. One of them hit the child in the heart. Within minutes of being hit, he was dead. Even before the time of internet and social media, word of the killing spread very fast. By late afternoon, dozens of angry people had gathered at the intersection of 3rd Street and Palo Avenue. So here's where it gets interesting. When the whole thing first started, when there were more police gathered on the street than protesters, and the best thing the protesters' disposal was rocks on the street, the local NAACP president called the mayor and told him the protesters were demanding to speak with him and said it would be good for the mayor to come out and talk to the kids because most of them were teenagers. Not sure whether this would have made a difference, but at any event, the mayor flatly refused to address or acknowledge the situation. Now, if I'm to assume, based on all reputable timelines, the mayor's refusal to speak with the protesters probably came around 3 p.m., It appears he was informed of the situation, and the NAACP called his office pretty quickly. Now, the buzz that was amongst the crowd began to hum with suggestions to burn down a local police station. Before long, there was an overturned car burning out on 3rd Street. Word spread amongst community leaders as well, and many of them began to report to the area, namely Commander Harry Nelson. Now, Commander Nelson and other civil rights leaders tried to calm the crowd, but they en masse shouted him down with demands as to whether or not the officer had been arrested for murder. Commander Nelson, whether he was speaking from a place of knowledge or not, told the crowd that an investigation was underway, and then he left around 6:45 p.m. After the crowd gathered, later that evening, there was a meeting held at the nearby Economic Opportunity Center where the protesters continued renewed demands that the officer be charged with murder. Truth be told, the city officials were amongst the organizers. For the meeting at the Economic Opportunity Center, they attempted in vain essentially to get the attention of the middle-class African Americans and compel them to drop the issue. The authorities couldn't comprehend how the assembled mass could want to see charges brought against the officer. But the police tried a different tactic. They actually appealed to the head of the Youth for Service, a ragtag collection of ex-gang members. But unfortunately, that had no real effect because the protesters existed outside of any gang structure. Now, I can't help but try to make a heavy parallel here. I'm sure it's not difficult to see the parallel between the situation with Officer Alvin Johnson and liken that to the egregious nature of the many murders to present day. Well, what about the treatment of the community by both the police and what amounts to the mayor's office? Each of them ran to the group that they know, then and even now. The mayor's office appealed to the civic-minded folk that gave penance and a vote, while the police went to the gang members. But no one went to the mass interest of the affected community and did the one thing that's still requested today: a formal, truthful investigation that leads to appropriate charges to commiserate the act. Now, in 1966, just as in recent years, by the time the then mayor Jack Shelley arrived and promised the crowd gathered near the Bayview Community Center that Officer Alvin Johnson had been suspended, it was too late. For the most part, the night of September 27th saw Bayview Hunters Point hit with some looting, rock throwing, and petty arson around town, but that was just the beginning. During the next 3 days, martial law was never declared, but the National Guard was dispatched on the city. In fact, over the next 3 days, San Francisco would experience its worst riots in almost 90 years since the anti-Chinese riots. Now, the quote community leaders tried to calm the situation the next day, but the cops actually issued an ultimatum. Calm by noon Wednesday, or massive force would be introduced. The leaders, mostly part of the middle-aged matriarchy and or the ministerial allies, had nothing to offer the rioters, and their pleas for calm went unheeded. Around 6 o'clock in the evening, a few hours after calling in the National Guard and Highway Patrol, the police responded to alleged gunfire by opening up on the Bayview Community Center and surrounding buildings. And after riddling it with hundreds of bullets, the police found no gunmen or weapons, but only several preteen kids huddled in the corner. At some point, there was a shootout between black motorists and the police at the corner of Newcomb and Mendel Streets. Now, the best source of information for the community center shooting actually comes from an October 1966 article published by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, of California, titled, "Hunters Point, Cops Shot into Community Center Sheltering 200 Children." Now, the SNCC article provides a bit of information into the shooting of Matthew Johnson, but then goes to suggest that several young men had gathered with the community center workers and an organization, the Youth for Service, to organize what was later called the Peace Patrol, numbering about 50 people. By early Wednesday morning, there were several radio broadcasts that reported the violence of Bayview had spread into the neighboring Fillmore District, but SNCC staff went there to find only a few broken windows and a lot of overhype at the amount of destruction and damage experienced. At some point, the Peace Patrol asked the police to go out and block 3rd Street so that no traffic could pass through. But the Peace Patrol had little effect in getting protesters to stop throwing rocks and bottles at passing cars, mainly because the police refused to block the street. Then, allegedly, a police officer was hit and the call passed over the radio, I'm hit, with the driver of the car calling into headquarters, my buddy is hit. But both officers refused or failed to identify what they meant by hit. The police, of course, assumed or presumed that hit meant shot. And by this time, there were over 500 people on 3rd Street, mostly young men. After those calls over the radio, the police rushed to 3rd Street and closed it to all traffic and marched their way up 3rd Street to the community center, all the while firing shots over the heads of residents and protesters on the street. When the police reached the community center, one officer yelled, "There's a gun in there somewhere, they're firing at us." Right after, on television and in the newspapers, people saw the police fire into the community center. At the time, more than 200 children were reported to be present inside the building. But of course, news of the children's presence didn't quite make it into the mainstream news media. So, needless to say, this broke the holiday mood, and the riot became a simple race confrontation, as the community at this point had every reason to assume the police were trying to kill them, and the police could no longer distinguish friend from foe except on racial terms. The long-suppressed anger over the abysmal status imposed on Black Americans was uncontainable, but even still, the riot was, for the most part, not terribly violent. The next 3 days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, from September 29th to October 1st, saw the riot continue with a decreasing incidence of violence and then finally kind of peter out. The property damage, several hundred thousands of dollars compared with riots in comparably sized cities, was pretty minimal, as were the casualties. 10 civilians reported being victims of gunshot wounds, no casualties amongst the police or other anti-riot personnel. Now, like its counterparts in Watts, it consisted, with few exceptions, of attacks on the property of whites, but also of non-whites. Shows of bravado calculated to frighten and cow police, and even running around and breaking windows to give the participants a feeling of real potency while actually not confronting the white power in any real significant way. Perhaps the best indication of the essentially passive character of the response of Black males in Hunters Point and the unreasonable magnitude of white fears is the fact that aside from long-range brick throwing, less than half a dozen assaults by Blacks against whites were recorded in the course of 5 days of, quote, rioting. Also, the fact that the riots took part in all parts of the city with sizable Black population, the Mission District, the Potrero Hill area, and the huge Fillmore District, and yet resulted in so few injuries indicates the presence of some restraining factor other than the police. I suggest it was the black rioters' internalized fear of whites that's so difficult to break down. Now, the police had until the early 60s dealt with black youth from Hunter's Point by isolating them there. One officer is quoted by Hipler on this technique, quote, "Get back up on the hill where you belong, nigger. If I see your black ass down here again, I'll shoot it off." When it was all said and done, the riot ended up being an uprising that saw dozens of fires set, a few police officers injured, residents of Hunter's Point shot, and the deployment of over 2,000 National Guard troops at the behest of then California Governor Edmund Brown. Considering that this uprising occurred after the 1960s Watts riots, this was nowhere near the magnitude of Watts, but the rioting has spread to the Fillmore District and they imposed a curfew to help quell, you know, the activity in the streets. So once the riot died down, many of the Hunters Point residents hoped that it would lead to much greater solidarity amongst the community within groups. But alas, the opposite occurred. The community essentially fell apart. There was widespread apathy and the general feeling of loss to such a degree that it was as though no one cared, and it was too late to do anything about the situation. Many businesses lining 3rd Street were boarded up, and unfortunately, many were reopened with liquor stores, quick check cashing, cheap wares and trinket shops, and basically all the trappings of places normally associated with poor, under-resourced, underfunded, and purposefully avoided and blighted neighborhoods. For the next 2 decades, Bayview Hunters Point carried the scarlet letter of being a high crime area. And that, of course, frightens developers and investors, terrifies legitimate home buyers, encourages slumlords and opportunists, and more than anything, it actually fosters the kind of isolation that bread rampant can bring. From the outside looking in, it's reminiscent to explain and see how the degree to which the government and others will go to suppress minority dissent in the United States. The deployment of automatic weapons, portable artillery, and federal troops, basically a military occupation. I'll let you tell me how many other times this has happened in recent memory. So the Bayview Hunters Point riot, though happening in 1966, is really not much different than the expressions of angst, anger, frustration, and disappointment that our communities continue to exhibit today. Whether it be New York City following Eric Garner's murder, or Minnesota following Philando Castile's murder, or even Chicago after Laquan McDonald, Ferguson after in the wake of Mike Brown, and you know as well as I do that the list goes on and on and on. So how do we rectify and correct the issues? I tend to believe that the notion of peaceful protest is as the way to go has gone from the minds of many. But violent reaction isn't the way either, especially with marginalized communities being fractured, outgunned, and outmanned. I tend to believe that it's through tacit strengthening of community economics and politics, namely because if you have one, you inevitably possess the other. If I control the economics of my community, city, state, region, etc., then I invariably control the politics, and the same is true vice versa. I do have a couple of pieces of listener mail I'd like to share with you, and I hope I don't butcher anyone's name too badly. Dear podcast team, I hope you're well. I just stumbled across your podcast yesterday by accident while searching for anyone and anything that could tell me more about Black history, specifically the Haitian Revolution. As soon as I saw the title, I knew I found what I was looking for, and you did not disappoint. The episodes are clear, concise, interesting, informative, and above all, exactly what we need in this day and age. I've listened to 7 episodes already and can see that I'm approaching the end. The latest one posted in May. Well, this is September. It's been some months, so that's entirely my fault. I apologize. I really hope that you continue posting these as they are really essential. I've spread the word to everyone I know who'd be interested in this. I'm from London and I'm developing a clothing line and events company that gets inspiration from the African diaspora. We're still so new, so I'm not at sponsorship level yet, but if I can help this podcast in any way, I will. Thank you for creating this. Kind regards, Ivy, I apologize. I'm not going to even butcher your last name. Please forgive me. But thank you for your letter. Another one I want to read. I only have 2 more to go, I promise. Hello, I just wanted to say that I discovered your podcast recently and I absolutely love it. The subjects you talk about and the perspectives you give on each topic are so refreshing and exciting. It's both fascinating and disturbing to learn about so much Black history that I haven't been exposed to, or indeed, to my shame, haven't actively sought out. I'm a history graduate from Oxford University, and I'm ashamed to say that the Black history of the American Revolution, as well as the history of the Black Panther Kathleen Cleaver, was something I knew very little about. I was faintly aware of the Congolese Holocaust, but the detail that you went into was again incredible and nauseating. It made me all the keener to go out and learn more about Black history and to prioritize Black sources and evidence, especially when researching more about Britain and Europe's shameful colonial past. I noticed you haven't released a new podcast in a while. I hope you haven't stopped recording and researching. Thank you again for all you've done, and I hope to see more episodes soon. Thank you very much, Jack Barnhart. Jack, you're absolutely right. You know, the degree to which the British, American, French, Belgian, German, for that matter, colonial past goes deep. It's infuriating. It's nauseating. It's sickening. It's all of those things. But, you know, the thing about it, the one thing I recognized very early on was that much of the African diaspora wasn't taught early. When you learn about these things of colonialism, it's almost taught as though colonialism was a good thing for the African diaspora. And we know, just essentially by reading and understanding the vestiges of history, that that's not the case. So, you know, obviously we have this episode here, and, you know, I promise there'll be another one coming up very quickly behind this one, Jack, but thanks for listening. Hopefully your studies go well at Oxford. And last letter that I read, and, you know, we'll wrap it up here. Hello, my name is Quidier Porter, and I'm an active listener in the podcast. I must say that your work is absolutely amazing. The podcast on Thomas Sankara and the Congo Holocaust really blew me away. I purchased the book We Are Heirs of the World's Revolutions and will soon purchase the one you recommended regarding King Leopold and the Congo as well. I really can't wait until the future podcasts come out. You are truly a gifted griot. Have a blessed day, Quidier Porter. Kadir, We Are the Heirs of the World's Revolution really opened me up to Thomas Sankara. It was an amazing read. You know, it's a collection of his speeches. You know, I don't recall the one offhand about King Leopold. I think it's, I wish I could recall it was called offhand right this second. It's on my shelf. I haven't even finished reading it just yet, but I need to. There's a few other books that I have that I've picked up in the recent past that I'll make sure I make recommendations for, you know, for you all, anyone who's interested. I think, actually, there was at least one reference in this podcast as well about Hunter's Point. And the article, actually, I encourage everyone to read the article that was released by SNCC. It's available online. You know, go back and, if you have to, go back and take a listen to what the title of it was. But if you type in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Hunter's Point Rebellion or Hunter's Point Riot, you should be able to find it pretty easily in a Google search. It looks like it's probably on like a microfiche, but, you know, it's a very good read. And I think it does give a very good synopsis and account as to what actually happened at the community center. You know, obviously I condensed it down as much as I possibly could for time's sake. I didn't read it verbatim. But as always, you know, anyone, if you have any feedback you'd like to leave for us, please feel free to drop a review in iTunes or the Google Play Store. And as well, you can shoot us an email at info@thisiscarrington.com. Again, that email is info@thisiscarrington.com. I actually meant what I said before. I'd love to get listener feedback on your thoughts and ideas as to how we can solve some of the issues of injustice that we currently have and have been facing for the last few hundred years. There are some things occurring at the highest levels of government in this country right now, and many of those things are seemingly designed to strip away the rights of minorities and other disenfranchised communities. So, you know, tell me your thoughts. I'll be sure to include them in a future episode. You know, and really and truthfully, you know, as I've said before, the listener letters really are what kind of encourage me to get back at the research and encourage me to get back to recording an episode and releasing one, because it actually shows me, you know, that you all appreciate what we're doing. You know, so hopefully you actually are enjoying the information we have to provide. And as always, If you notice or catch any mistakes, omissions, errors, or the like, you know, let us know that too. Much of the reason our podcasts don't come out at any particular regular interval is because they are so research intensive. And as I've said to you, we strive to find instances in history that you probably haven't heard of before. So, you know, therefore the source list is nowhere near as great as, you know, if we were doing an episode on Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or, you know, something that's more mainstream. But you know, if nothing else, it's a labor of love and a very time consuming task to make sure that the information is correct as presented. But again, if you catch a mistake, please let us know, because as we say here, only steel can sharpen steel. I hope each of you have a great day, a blessed week, a powerful month, and a fulfilled year. Till next time.